Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation. The entire cost is approximately $350,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration. He stands there at the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, a prophetic voice, literally a voice. That's how he is predicted at the end of the Old Testament, a voice of one crying in the wilderness. That's how he describes himself. I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Jesus says the same thing of him. So John the Baptist, for speaking the word of God, is in prison, and eventually we know, in that famous and tragic scenario, will die as a martyr at the hands of King Herod at the whim of his illegal wife. It's a tragic story, but what does it mean that John goes as a martyr before the one he is running before, Jesus? Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this Tuesday, August the 25th, we are going to remember the martyrdom of John the Baptist. Dr. Jeff Gibbs joins us. He's Emeritus Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary and author of the Concordia Commentaries on Matthew. Dr. Gibbs, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to hear your voice. Haven't talked in a while.
Before we get into the martyrdom itself, let's talk about the imprisonment that led up to it. It's sometimes unclear from the way that the Gospels record this, but did Jesus wait until John was in prison to begin his public ministry?
Well, I like the way you said it, Todd. It's not quite clear. If we only had Matthew, for instance, that's kind of what it sounds like, right? Because there in chapter 4, that's the way Matthew tells the sequence. But as we know, the Gospels are not always what we would call strictly chronological. If you read the Gospel of John, there seems to be an overlap, right, of John's baptizing ministry, and then Jesus has some activity after the disciples first begin to follow him, because John has pointed to Jesus and says, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." I do think there's a kind of a theological connection between John's imprisonment and martyrdom and the Lord's own mission and ministry. But whether historically, you know, Jesus waited and that was kind of the ready, set, go mark, I think we probably have to be not quite certain about that.
What led to John's imprisonment?
Here's a phrase that gets used in various ways: speaking the truth to power. Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, one of the sons of Herod the Great, was the ruler of Galilee in those regions, and he took as wife a woman named Herodias, who was the wife of his brother, Herod Philip, and while Herod Philip was still living. And John the Baptist knew that this was against the will of God, and so he denounced him. And for that reason, and maybe for others, Herod imprisoned John the Baptist.
There's something to be noted there, and if you look at what John actually said to Herod or of Herod, it is not lawful for you to take her, I think is the words that he used. It might shock Lutheran sensibilities to note that ultimately John is imprisoned and martyred for preaching the law.
Exactly. Exactly right. And for, as one, for calling things like they are. And John, as we know from the samples of his preaching that we do have, is not afraid to say things in, shall we say, stark terms. He speaks of wheat and chaff and coming fire and judgment. So it's not, in that sense, too surprising that John would be perfectly willing to call out, as we say today, King Herod Antipas.
It also offends our kind of libertarian sensibilities. You know, what does this prophet of God, why is he bothering to talk to the civil leaders of his day and comment on their morality? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I have lots of them. God's law is God's law. I mean, it applies to everyone, right? It's wrong for a believer to lie. It's wrong for an unbeliever to lie. It's wrong for a believer to marry his brother's wife. It's wrong for an unbeliever to do it. And so, yeah, John is not afraid to mess with whatever political party, I'll just say it that way, that he thinks is in violation of God's law. In this case, of course, they weren't political parties. It was a ruler, a monarch, serving under Rome's blessing. But yeah, God's law is God's law.
Staying with that imprisonment for a minute here, there's at least some indication of a, I'm just going to say, for lack of a better word, love-hate relationship on Herod's part between him and John the Baptist. He seems fascinated with him.
Yes.
And then even reluctant to ultimately kill him.
Yes, yes. One of the Gospels says that he heard him gladly, and he was reluctant to do the deed at first because John is popular among the people, even though probably they don't even really understand the significance of John. Jesus has to teach the crowds that are following him about John's true significance. We don't exactly know what's going on in Herod's mind and heart, but there is some ambivalence. Maybe the truth is trying to get in there in John's heart, but it ultimately fails.
During John's imprisonment, and before his martyrdom, there is what appears to be a crisis of faith on the part of the prophet. He sends some of his disciples to Jesus asking that question, are you the one, or shall we look for another? What do you think is going on there?
Right. That's a great question. And again, we have to be sort of cautious. I would say it's this, and there are a number of other examples, right? Moses. They're not too long out in the wilderness, and the children of Israel murmur. I'd have to look it up. It might even be the incident with the golden calf. And Moses says to God, you did this to me, right? You brought me out in the wilderness and are laying the burden of this people on me. Well, that's not true. But it's not turning out the way Moses thought it was going to, right? And the prophet, the literal human prophet, Elijah, in Kings, is the same way. You know, has this great victory at Mount Carmel over the prophets of Baal. And then Jezebel is going to kill him. And off he runs to Mount Sinai. And he says, in so many words, this isn't turning out the way I thought it was going to turn out. So it's understandable. It happens to men of faith and prophets and chosen servants throughout history. And I just think that John is one of those examples. He announced the coming of the reign of God. As I like to say sometimes, this is not the reign of Bill. This is not the reign of Frank. This is the reign of God, Almighty God. But his enemies look like they're winning, and John's own situation is case in point number one. So Jesus, if you're the Messiah, if you're bringing the reign of God, if you're the Lamb of God, why doesn't it look right? Why am I still in prison? And ultimately, he gets his head chopped off. In Lutheran terms, this is our theology of the cross, that when God is at work, it so often looks like the opposite of what we think it should. It so often looks like defeat, when in God's plan and God's way, it's actually really success and victory.
So John had preached the coming of a Messiah who would carry a winnower's fork in his hand and lay the axe at the root of the trees and execute immediate judgment. Do you think that's part of the tension that John is feeling there?
Yes, I do. And by the way, John was right. We call it Judgment Day, right? But should we say that John's timing is off, or he isn't patient enough? And, you know, believers today, we look around us and we see greed and we see hatred, we see abortion, we see racism, we see oppression, we see evil everywhere, and we think, where is God? I mean, why is he not making things right? The promise, of course, is one day he will make things right, and he has made things right, but not in a way that looks impressive to normal human perspectives.
That question sent to Jesus via John's disciples occasions,
yes,
Jesus teaching, as you mentioned before, teaching the people about who John is and what John is doing. What does he say there?
Yeah, he says something really remarkable. He actually says that John is greater than a prophet. He actually fulfills prophecy himself. And the prophecy that John fulfills is the one at the end of the book of the prophet Malachi that talks about the Lord's messenger coming to his temple that talks about the great and terrible day of the Lord, and the one whom God will send, the prophet Malachi says, is Elijah. I will send Elijah. Now, the human figure Elijah, the original prophet Elijah, has been dead for 500 years or something when Malachi prophesies. But Jews heard that prophecy, and they thought about it. They speculated about it. And Jesus actually says that John the Baptizer fulfills that prophecy. He is Elijah, which means that the great and terrible day of the Lord has come. But once again, it's a day of the Lord that can be resisted. It's a day of the Lord whereby its bringers, first John and then Jesus, can be hated and opposed and even killed. Of course, Jesus wins the ultimate victory in his resurrection, but this is the paradox and the strange way that God has decided to carry out his plan in and through first John, but also, of course, especially the Lord Jesus.
Jesus asks that rhetorical question, what did you go out to see, with reference to John? What point is he making there?
Well, he's just trying to get them to rethink, I think. Was it a reed shaken by the wind? People normally take this to mean someone whose opinion could be changed readily. Was it someone with the trappings of wealth and success and comfort, you know, dressed in soft clothing? There's probably a little touch of irony there in Matthew 11. Those who wear soft clothing, Jesus says, are in king's houses. John's in a king's prison. But someone greater than a prophet, he's prophesied about. But then, because this is opaque to us and to our perceptions, Jesus actually says, if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is about to come. Now, it doesn't mean that whether or not we believe it makes John Elijah. The fact of the matter is, he was Elijah. But it's easy to reject this message because of what his being Elijah looks like. And then Jesus ends that paragraph, as you know, with, let the one who has ears hear. Jesus calls for faith in this declaration that doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like.
Do we know how long John languished in prison before the event of his execution?
Yeah, I don't think we know. I was just looking, I knew we were going to chat this afternoon, and the Gospels don't tell us, and Josephus has a couple of references to both Herod's marriage to his brother's wife, and then also to his imprisonment of John, and I don't think it says. There's one guess that puts the martyrdom of John at about 32 A.D., but that kind of depends on some other chronological guesswork that may or may not be right, so obviously before the end of Jesus' ministry, his death and resurrection. But I don't think we know how long John languished in prison.
Dr. Jeff Gibbs is our guest. We're talking about the martyrdom of John the Baptist. We'll tell the story, as tragic and senseless as it is, next. Church and state, communion fellowship, the church year, baptism, Lutheranism. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August is a simple explanation series. It's a pack of 20 pamphlets with solid biblical guidance on various Christian topics. A simple explanation pamphlet is perfect for outreach programs, new member classes, and in the church pews. Learn more at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. A simple explanation series.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Your daily Lutheran Bible class. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
We're talking about the martyrdom of John the Baptist, observed by the church on the 29th of August. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Gibbs, author of the Concordia Commentaries on Matthew. Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. That's what you'll hear daily on Issues, Etc. And if you appreciate this worldwide outreach, please consider making a special gift toward our new studios and offices. A generous donor has agreed to match up to $200,000 for the building and renovation. The total cost is approximately $375,000. Find out how to contribute at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Dr. Gibbs, the story of John's martyrdom is tragic, I think senseless. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the old-fashioned word, Todd, that came to my mind when I was thinking about it is the word tawdry. You know, it's kind of distasteful. So Herod is celebrating his birthday with his nobility and honored guests. And Herodias, his wife, she hates John, and she wants to get rid of him. She actually traps Herod in his own words, remembering that it's an honor-shame culture, much more so than ours. So to be respected, to be a man of your word, to keep a public promise that you've made, to avoid shame like this is very important, and the more quote-unquote important a person you are, the more important it is to avoid shame like that. So in the midst of the banquet, Herodias sends her daughter Salome in to quote-unquote dance for the guests. In every likelihood, this is a sexualized sort of thing, and Herod actually promises to give Salome, the daughter of his wife, whatever she wants, up to the half of his kingdom. And so Salome dutifully goes to her mother and says, "What shall I ask for?" And Herodias says, "Get the head of John the Baptist on a platter." And that's what she does. I can only imagine Herod's, as you said earlier, his ambivalence, you know, this love-hate relationship with John and his words. But now he's trapped and he has a choice. He can choose his own honor and his own status, or he can choose what I suspect he knew to be right. And he chose his own honor, and so he's trapped in his own words. And he sends John as beheaded. It's hard to imagine the gruesomeness of the scene, right? So the head of John the Baptist is presented on a platter. What more gruesome, shameful, pathetic scene can you imagine? And the answer is, well, I can think of one. It's Jesus dying on the cross, right? Which is the ultimate path and pattern and way that God sends his lamb to take away the sin of the world. But to every human expectation, it looks like the opposite of what it is. And so John and Jesus, of course, they're related through their mothers, but their lives are patterned together. And so John's death foreshadows Jesus' death in more than one way. And one of the ways is that in the world's scheme of things, it's a shameful, dishonorable, pathetic death that can only mean defeat, right? God has a different idea, of course.
So it strikes me that Herod here is forced by his own lack of wisdom into a position that many before him have occupied, and that is persecuting and killing the prophets.
Right.
Is John's martyrdom here kind of the capstone of that edifice that has Jesus talks about the blood of the prophets being spilled and things like that, and they treated the prophets before you like this when they persecute you? Is John's martyrdom, not discounting the cross, of course, but in terms of the prophets, is it the capstone?
Well, that's an interesting question, Todd, because when Jesus does, you know, he's denouncing the Pharisees in Matthew 23, and he says, look, all the righteous blood of human history is going to come upon this generation, that uniquely responsible group of people. Not that we're all not responsible for the death of Jesus, we are, but there's a sense in which that generation was unique. But it's interesting because he doesn't include John in that summary, right? He says, from the blood of Abel, the righteous, to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you killed between the temple and the altar, right? And I don't know why he doesn't name John in that statement, unless it's because John's death is so closely identified with Jesus' own death, right? And John, as you know, in that back in Matthew 11, in that chapter, on the one hand, John partakes of the old era, if I could say it that way. The law and the prophets prophesied until John, Jesus says. So he's kind of the end of the old. But at the same time, John partakes of the new era. Together with Jesus, John fulfills all righteousness in Matthew 3. And so I'm not sure, but it might be that John's death needs to be even more closely related to Jesus' own death. Not because Jesus' death isn't unique, it obviously is, but it's interesting he does not name him as the last item, if I can say it that way, in that long history, as you described it, of persecuting and killing the prophets. That's an Old Testament phenomenon, and now perhaps John is so closely associated as the forerunner of Christ, his death is to be more closely associated with Jesus' own death.
In that sense, at least in terms of how the story runs, does John's death, at least like story-wise, seal Jesus' fate as well? John's died, now Jesus is going to die.
Well, yes, and you know, the Gospel of Luke especially, I know my good friend Art Just in his commentary has really traced out beautifully the ways that Jesus and John are paralleled, especially in the early chapters of Luke's gospel. But yeah, they track together, right? And so what happens to the one happens to the other. I'm thinking about, of course, I should know Luke better, but I know Matthew better. But on the way down from the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus tells Peter, James, and John, don't tell anyone what you saw until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. The disciples ask him, then why did the scribes say Elijah must come first? He answered, Elijah does come and restore all things, but I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they didn't recognize him, but they did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. See, there's that connection. And so, you know, the way you said it was, as far as the story goes, John's dead, he's been martyred, guess what's coming for Jesus? And again, it's so, we're such Americans, we define, you know, success and power and wisdom in certain ways, and we're trained to do this by our culture. But I have it on good authority, Todd, that the power of God is stronger, the foolishness of God is stronger than men, and the wisdom of God is wiser than men. That's from some other author a little bit later in the New Testament.
Why is there such concern on the part of Herod and the other religious leaders that John the Baptist isn't going to stay dead, that he's going to rise again? They even mistake Jesus.
Right, right. Well, I just think that this is a part of the utter confusion about what it meant for a Messiah to come. We sometimes act and speak as if there was kind of a unified expectation among first century Judaism about what the last day would be or what the Messiah would be or what God would do when he finally came to visit his people. But there was not. It was not monolithic. It was not uniform. There's speculation. There's variety. And you can see this if you just read some of the surviving literature from that time period. So I just think that it's part of that general confusion. You know, in the gospel reading for last Sunday from Caesarea Philippi, you know, who do people say that I am? Well, the disciples don't say, oh, they all think you're an earthly leader. No, they, well, some say this, some say that, see? So I just think it's part of that fervor and ferment of something. They're looking for something to happen, but do they agree on what it might be? And the answer is absolutely not.
But they do seem to at least acknowledge that it has something to do with Jesus. Something's yes. going on. It has something to do with Jesus, but beyond that, there's confusion.
Correct. He's either the Messiah, or he's in league with Satan, or he's something. But yeah, Jesus is getting their attention. The Pharisees think he's in league with Satan, at least some of them do. I think it's important for us to be aware, it helps us to read the New Testament better, that, again, there would have been some common strains of expectation, common threads or about what Jewish believers or Jewish people were looking for, but it was not uniform. The one thing they didn't expect was weakness. They didn't expect defeat, only then to be followed by victory.
The one thing Jesus says about John the Baptist that I think we find at least somewhat confusing, he in essence says he's the greatest man who ever lived, obviously save Christ himself. But he says right. No one born of women is greater. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think he means that God is doing a new thing. See, this is, I mentioned a minute ago that in some ways John the Baptist belongs in the Old Testament era, right, leading up to the time of fulfillment. So he has one foot in that old era of God's plan to save us all, but he also has a foot in the new era, right? And so when Jesus says that, no one among those born of women is greater than John the Baptist, I think that emphasizes that second point, and that is John partakes of, he's the end of the old era in a way, but in another way, he's also part of the beginning of the new. So it's a way of saying, look, something new has come. In fact, the reign of God has come near, and John is its forerunner. He announces it, and for that reason, because it's all about the reign of God that has newly come into the world, for that reason, John is the greatest born among women.
Is that why he follows it up saying, but the least in the kingdom is greater than him?
Exactly right. Because that's what matters now. Now that Jesus is on the scene, what matters is to belong to him and to come under his gracious rule. That's right.
So finally, what do we learn about a God who would send prophet after prophet after prophet only to have them largely ignored, persecuted, exiled, martyred, and then the last prophet that he sends, that he even promises in the Old Testament, ends up in prison with his head separated from his body on a silver platter, the object of, even in death, of mockery and ridicule?
Right. That's a good question, and I would say maybe this. You can't figure this God out on your own. His ways, his purposes have to be revealed to you. And you need a reliable source for understanding and knowing this God. That reliable source has to have credentials. And Todd, I'd like to mention that there is one such reliable source. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. He reveals God. No one has ever seen God, the only begotten God in the bosom of the Father. He has made him known. And his credential is that he rose from the dead. We learn about God, the Father, through the Son and through the Son alone.
Dr. Jeff Gibbs is Emeritus Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary and author of the Concordia Commentaries on Matthew. You can purchase these commentaries by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Gibbs, thank you again.
Thank you, Todd. Appreciate it.
We'll be talking about the abortion drug Mifeprex with Lila Rose, president of Live Action, right after this break. thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and the Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org
or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I am far more concerned than what's happening at the editorial page by what's happening in news pages.
Molly Hemingway speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
In news pages, that old idea that we had for a few decades of aiming toward objectivity has just been completely thrown out the window.
And this is a generalization, but I think it bears out. And again, I mean, even 5-10 years ago, it would have sounded crazy that I'd be saying this, but I mean, I think it is the case. You have to view the explicit goal of most of the major journalistic institutions in this country as electing Democrats. And when they aren't electing Democrats, they're trying to push the Democratic Party further left.
You can watch and listen to a recording of journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway's Q&A from our 2020 Making the Case conference. It's available in both video and audio formats for a tax-deductible contribution of $250. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your will. Us who us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.